Hello, and a very warm welcome to all of you. You are listening to episode 3 of our PolicyCorner.org podcast series, where today we will be talking about the Paris Climate Agreement, reached in 2016, and how it may serve as a blueprint for an international climate displacement agreement. My name is Felix Hoffmann, and this is our podcast series where, once a month, we discuss articles published on our website PolicyCorner.org with their authors. You can send us feedback to podcast@policycorner.org and, of course, subscribe on iTunes or check out our website. There, you also find all the information on how to submit an article and join our team. Before we start talking about climate change and migration, and I finally introduce today's guests, let me briefly advertise for our writing competition on new economic policy. If you're a young scholar and interested in economics, check out the essay competition page on our website. You can win cash prizes and even a trip to Berlin. So go ahead and check it out. It is definitely worth your time and a great opportunity to publish your ideas and get involved in the conversation about new approaches to economic policy. But let's get started. Today, there's three of us. And here with me are Alina Bill-Weiland and Delia Rohling. It's great to have you. Thanks so much for being here. Just give us a short idea of who you are and what you have to do with the Policy Corner.
Hi, thanks for the invitation first. So we both do the German-French double master's degree at Freie Universität Berlin and Sciences Po Paris. And Delia has her concentration in European politics and I have my concentration in international relations. I did the master's in environmental policy in Paris, and I am particularly interested in international climate politics and environmental justice. In my research, I focused on Latin America, and at the Policy Corner, I'm part of the communications team, reviewer, and treasurer.
So hello, everyone. I'm really happy to be here. And as Alina already said, I did a master's in European affairs at Sciences Po. And my main interests are also environmental politics, human rights, and health policies, especially in Europe and Latin America. For the Policy Corner, I am actively involved in the communications and the recruitment team.
Okay, thanks so much, guys. You co-authored an article called Seeking an International Climate Displacement Agreement, in which you argue that there currently is a gap in international law when it comes to recognizing the status of people who have been displaced by the effects of climate change. So, why exactly is current international law insufficient to cover climate refugees, and how big of a problem is climate displacement actually?
Okay, so I think it's important to stress first the point why it is actually a problem. There are several estimates about the potential impact of climate and or environmental refugees among the displacement flows that will happen in the near future, so more or less until 2050. So they depend on the exact group of people that are taking into account and the method of measurement. But for example, if you take the so-called Stern report or Stern review published in 2007 by the top economist of the World Bank, Nicholas Stern, he indicates that like more or less 150 up until 200 million people would become climate refugees until 2050. And in comparison, for example, the NGO Christian Aid indicated in 2007 that it was likely that about 50 million people would become environmental refugees, and another 250 million climate refugees would most likely erase until 2050. So there are really different estimates that are offered to us, so we cannot really know how many people will actually be displaced. But we know that already now climate displacement poses some difficulties in the most affected regions. So those regions are especially in Asia and on the Pacific Islands. And with regards to the international sphere and the main focus of our article, it's really important to stress that the issue is becoming more and more pressing and that it will at some point affect also the overall state community. So that is why we think that it's so important to already discuss the topic now and to raise awareness about the situation that we are most likely going to face in the coming years. So now would still be the time to avoid a situation, for example, like the immigration chaos that Europe is facing since 2015. So we need to start acting right now.
All right.
Yeah, the most important international document for the protection of refugees is the Geneva Convention, and this document does not apply for climate refugees. So this is a real problem, because when the convention was drafted, people didn't think about climate change. So the convention focuses on people who are forced to leave their country because they fear to be persecuted due to their race, religion, nationality, or their belonging to a specific social group, but not climate change. The non-refoulement principle prohibits states to send asylum seekers back to their countries of origin if their life or their liberty are at risk because of the reasons that I just mentioned. But yeah, the adverse effects of climate change are not one of these reasons. So that's like a legal gap that we have in the international system. Now there are different international human rights documents that are relevant for those displaced by the negative impacts of climate change. For example, the International Covenant on Economic, Social and Cultural Rights, or the Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, that oblige states to protect human rights of all people within their territory, regardless of their citizenship. When the environment of people becomes uninhabitable because of a drought or a flooding or soil salination, the first thing that people do would be to move within their country. So in that case, the country of origin is responsible to protect their human rights. But if the infrastructures in that country are unstable and resilience is rather low, then people might cross borders and go to another country. In this case, according to the Covenant, the receiving state is responsible for the protection of these people's human rights. Yeah, so we see that climate change could threaten all different human rights, like the right to food, to water, to health, or to an adequate standard of living. So states that committed to these rights and to protect them, they are obliged to act right now. That's what we tried to talk about in our article. And one important point to consider when we talk about climate change is that those who suffer the most from climate change are the ones that have contributed the least to its occurrence. So the rich and industrialized countries in the global north have substantially contributed to global greenhouse gas emissions. And in order to make sure that existing human rights are protected and that affected people can claim their rights, we need this new international climate displacement agreement. That would be one step towards climate justice.
All right. So you already mentioned the astonishing numbers of potential climate refugees. So climate change could definitely be considered a threat multiplier. It strengthens already existing threats. It aggravates the shortage of water and cultivatable land, it threatens livelihoods, and it can inflame tensions and lead to political unrest. An international agreement on how to deal with the resulting migration flows seems necessary, obviously, but what about preventative measures?
Well, yeah, I think we need both. We could say that an international climate displacement agreement would urge states to increase their mitigation and adaptation ambitions as they would have to reduce their greenhouse gas emissions and increase the capacity to adapt to changing climate conditions. We know that climate scientists say that if we stopped emitting right now and emissions dropped to a zero level today, there would still be loss and damage related to climate change. This is because of the inertia of the climate system. Greenhouse gases usually stay in the atmosphere for a very long time. So for CO2, for example, it's about 120 years. And when emissions are reduced, the surface air temperature would still continue to increase for another century. And the sea level, in this case, it's even worse. The inertia is even higher because the mass is very big of the ocean. And yeah, that is why we need to think about solutions in the long term. Climate displacement is already taking place today, and mitigation and adaptation are not sufficient measures to deal with climate displacement. So what we think is that the international community needs to develop instruments to address unavoidable loss and damages. This is already done in the framework of the Warsaw mechanism, for example, and the international community needs to close the legal gap that we see right now regarding climate displacement.
All right, so in your article, you argued that this climate displacement agreement could be built upon structures and processes that were established during the negotiations for the Paris Climate Agreement. If we think about the recent withdrawal of the United States from that deal and the difficulties of establishing mechanisms to address long-term problems on the international stage, the difficulties of establishing these mechanisms in the first place, is such an approach a realistic option, or shouldn't we rather concentrate on implementing the Paris Climate Agreement that we just reached?
Well, that's a really interesting question that is really hard to respond to. I would say that the Paris Climate Accord was, notwithstanding the deplorable pullout of the US, still largely considered as a successful step towards a global agreement about climate change and the first real commitment towards its fighting. So, as Alina already told you, even if the states were to implement the Paris Accord as quickly as possible and following thoroughly the fixed emission reduction targets, and that would still not be enough because there would still occur some changes in the climate system that will have long-term consequences. So a lot of experts are already alarming on the fact that there will be irreparable changes in the climate equilibrium, and that weather will be deregulated and the planet's temperature will raise even if we instantly reduced our carbon emissions to zero, which won't happen, obviously. So the consequences on the planet's climate system and ecosystem are likely to be even more serious in some years. So we think that Paris is a good start, but it's not sufficient yet, because the people are already moving and they will continue to be in the future displaced because of the consequences of climate change and because their habitat is just becoming uninhabitable. So we think there needs to be a process, a parallel process of establishing a protection regime for those affected and those displaced. And as you already noted, those mechanisms take a really long time to be established on the international stage. So that's why we advocate that the discussions about the topic should be made more prominently already in prevision of future challenges. So the Paris Accord might still serve, for example, as an instrument, because with the US withdrawal or without the US withdrawal, it showed that it's possible to get a lot of states around the same table and to say sign the same document. So if it worked once, maybe it might be possible to build upon existing cooperation structures and draft a new agreement. For now, we agree that it's not really a realistic option, but should several states show their readiness and will to act jointly, we hope that it might become a realistic option pretty soon.
So we definitely need some optimism there. A climate displacement agreement would certainly be a step in the right direction. But so what do you think needs to happen in order to actually pressure governments to take the necessary steps to implement these measures? What role would affected communities and civil society in general play in this process?
Okay, so we already raised this point before, but for example, an international agreement that we advocate for that would cover climate displacement and confer rights and protection to its victims, such an agreement would need to be adopted on the international stage. So international borders are involved and international cooperation would be needed to address such a problem or challenge. And the principal actors on the international stage are states. So the impulse for such an agreement must come from national governments. In democracies, governments have already and always a strong interest to be re-elected. So that's why inner pressure is a powerful tool to provoke the government to act. And this inner pressure can come from civil society, for example, or from non-governmental organizations, from economic actors, from different parties in the political opposition, or actually any kind of pressure group that aggregates people around the same interest. And if enough voices are raised to pressure the government to take action, and especially if those voices are potential voters for the next election, the government might place more importance on the potential action it could take and on the potential steps it could follow on the international stage. So the more governments are internally pressured by their domestic electorate to take international action, the more nations might decide to take a next step, and the more pressure would also be put on reluctant states from the outside, so the other states in international negotiations. So we might hope that there could be a kind of snowball effect taking place until it seems like ethically or morally, politically impossible not to join international action for a climate displacement agreement. And you raised an interesting point talking about affected communities and civil society, because they are key to this process. Civil society organizations in developed countries, but also in the mostly undeveloped or developing countries, they are really the first who can exercise a kind of pressure, because they can organize and pressure groups and raise the public awareness about the topic and put it on society's agenda. They have a really strong say in the whole debate, because affected communities can report from firsthand about the consequences and challenges that they are facing, and they can contribute to inform about it and to nourish the debate. So we think that both civil society and affected countries should more closely work together, and they should raise public attention and provoke a general debate about climate displacement.
So it seems like this is a very labor-intensive process. So what would be an alternative approach to climate displacement besides an international agreement that, you know, might take a very long time to negotiate and be even more difficult to actually implement?
Well, there is a range of possible approaches to address climate displacement and to close this legal gap that I talked about earlier. But maybe let me start by talking about the international processes that are going on. And yeah, I think bilateral agreements are also one option, as we saw it in the case of New Zealand, that allowed families from Tuvalu to come to New Zealand, as they considered them as climate refugees. But yeah, what's going on the international agenda? So one option, a fourth amendment protocol to the Geneva Convention, but this is probably the least likely and the least desirable option, especially under current conditions with strong isolationist tendencies and wall-up policies in different countries. It would be dangerous to open up the Geneva Convention. And yeah, because some forces might try to weaken existing refugee rights. It's like a Pandora's box. If you open it, you can cause harm to the ones that fall under the convention. Then another process would be the international climate negotiations under the United Nations Framework Convention for Climate Change, the UNFCCC. There's already an established structure that works on climate-induced displacement. In 2013, at the conference in Warsaw, there was this international mechanism for loss and damage that was created, and yeah, it tries to address loss and damage caused by climate change. And yeah, there was a task force on displacement that was established to develop recommendations for integrated approaches to minimize and address displacement related to climate change. This task force has a really great potential, I think, to develop a solution to close the legal gap. And yeah, we have to see how this whole process ends, because the task of this task force is to develop recommendations that could be fed into the negotiations at the climate conference in 2018, and we have to see how it will be included or if it ends up in a new legal document. Another window of opportunity to close the legal gap is the Global Compact. Last year, in September, the General Assembly of the United Nations adopted the New York Declaration for Refugees and Migrants. States have committed to start negotiations leading to an international conference and the adoption of a global compact for safe, orderly, and regular migration in 2018. Just recently, in May, there was an informal session for the Global Compact where they talked about drivers of migration and also about climate change as one main driver. Yeah, there was actually one of our professors, François Gemin, who talked at the panel. So, yeah, there are definitely things going on and researchers talking about the topic. Also, different states gathered and in the framework of the Nansen Initiative, and they created a protection agenda for cross-border displaced persons. And there are so far 109 governments that support this agenda. So maybe this could lead up into a new agreement. We'll see.
Okay, so there at least seems to be an initiative. I want to touch upon a topic that you briefly talked about earlier, which is the fact that those that are responsible or largely responsible for climate change are not the ones actually bearing the costs. Because climate change and its long-term impacts affect different regions of the world to a different extent. So what do you think needs to happen to get those states on the table that do not consider climate change an immediate threat to their interests?
That's, again, a really tricky question, and now you urge me to say this. We really need to understand and get around the fact that climate change is a phenomenon that is not restrained to national borders. So that is why for people that deal with climate change or that are interested about the topic, it's hardly even conceivable how any state of the world could consider that climate change would not touch its vital interests or its national interests or any interest at all, because it touches our every interest that we have if we lose our habitat. So even though the impacts of climate change lead to displacement primarily maybe in other parts of the world and not in the occidental developed world, right now provisions say that already in our countries there will be some affected populations in some years. So in order to prevent even in our occidental sphere more or less the situation that Europe faced during the last years, where a high number of displaced people entered its frontiers and they didn't have any clear guidance, they didn't receive any support or help and not even real protection at some times, there could or should even be a preventive conclusion of an agreement that determines the status of the people that are displaced by the consequences of climate change. And this agreement is really necessary because for now those people don't even have a status. We don't know what they are. We don't know what kind of protection they could even get. And as mentioned before, in order for states to consider something their vital interest, the population needs to consider it their vital interest first. So they need to pressure their own government to take a clearer stance on the topic. And inner pressure and awareness is thus also the key for that matter. So especially considering the states which are currently traditionally a so-called climate sceptic, the US would be, for example, under Donald Trump, an example for a climate sceptic state. So it's a state that doesn't really acknowledge that climate change is happening and mostly or influentially man-made. There needs to be some states setting off an international dynamic, and those states that are setting off that dynamic, they need to put political and ethical pressure on the reluctant states so that in fact those would also join the table and the international negotiations. So to underline, for example, that outer pressure that I talked about a bit earlier, the terms of partnerships or other agreements could maybe be hardened or revised so that also diplomatic pressure comes into place and that, for example, some outer preventive measures or even some sanctions could be conceivable. So we need to see how the situation evolves in the coming years.
And it's definitely a change of mindset and of responsibilities of in the framework of climate justice that plays a very important role to for this bottom-up process where civil society starts a process and governments in the end gather to change the legal system can take place.
All right. Fascinating talk. Thanks so much for being here, Alina and Delia. Go check out their article on policycorner.org. It's called Seeking an International Climate Displacement Agreement. And also check out our writing competition and, you know, why not submit an article? You can find all the information at policycorner.org. Thank you so much for listening to episode 3 of our podcast series. The next episode will likely take some more time since I will be traveling, but we will be back. If you like this podcast, please feel free to subscribe and tell your friends. My name is Felix Hoffmann, and that's it for the policycorner.org podcast. See you next month.